The Michael Jackson album Thriller turns 25 this year. It's still the top-selling album of all time. And if you were a kid back in the early 80s, when it came out, it defined your sense of cool for years to come. Rashad Olison was about 7 when his mom surprised him with a brown paper bag from Camelot Music. He was speechless when he reached inside and pulled out his very own copy of Thriller.
Once I dropped the needle and it slid into the grooves of I Want to Be Starting Something, the first cut on that on side one, instant disco. And it was instant fun. I mean, my sisters and I danced that album all night long.
That music helped Rashad get through some rough times. His parents' divorce, his loneliness at school, and it eventually helped him pick a career. Rashad is now a music critic. He recently reviewed Michael Jackson's 25th anniversary tribute album for his newspaper, The Baltimore Sun. It was a great excuse for Rashad to reflect on a magical moment in pop music and to remember a vivid chapter from his own life history. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
This year, in tribute to Thriller's 25th anniversary, artists from Kanye West to Akon to will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas have covered, redone, and mashed up the album's famous songs.
Every night she walks right in my dreams. She's a man from the start. I'm so proud I am the only one who is special in her heart. The girl is mine.
She mine, she mine, she mine.
Don't go ahead.
She like the way I rock, the way I rock, the way I rock, the way
I know
I rock.
She's mine.
She mine, she mine, she mine.
Don't go ahead.
She like the way I rock.
Remixes like this one, along with the digitally remastered originals, have been released together this year as part of a special anniversary version of Thriller. Now, those of us of a certain generation will remember trying to perfect our moonwalks during recess time in grade school, wearing one glove and wishing for that red vinyl jacket with all the zippers. It's hard to explain just what a big deal that Michael Jackson Thriller phenomenon was to a kid back in 1982. For Rashad Olison, the album came into his life at a rough time.
My parents had divorced around that time. I think he was around 6 years old. And I remember very clearly being depressed, you know, because my parents were split up and the divorce was kind of ugly. And, you know, I mean, I'm a kid, so I remember feeling sad that my father wouldn't be around. And most importantly, that we wouldn't go to the record shop every Friday anymore.
That was a tradition with you and your dad?
Yeah, it was a tradition early on. Early on, there was always music in the house. Funk and blues and R&B, Motown, a lot of Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, yeah. Sunshine, blues, guys, please go. My man has found another.
He would go to the record shop every Friday after he picked me up from school, and it was something I looked forward to every weekend.
And that sort of regular Friday chapter of your life kind of disappeared then when your folks got divorced?
It disappeared, and I was sad, yeah. You know, to say the least. I was just down and out about that.
Rashad lived with his mom and his sisters in a public housing complex in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And that spring, 1983... something really nice was happening around the neighborhood.
Where I lived in the projects, I mean, we heard Thriller all the time. There was a park right up the street. And when I remember Thriller, I remember warm weather because it was either spring or the summer. I think our neighbor had the album.
So you heard this music coming out of a neighbor's window? Like you would hear bits and pieces of it?
In neighbor's windows, in the park up the street, because DJs in the summertime would spin right across from the basketball court.
Who would dance on the floor in the round? She told me her name was Billie Jean, and she calls
it was like just music kind of filled the air. Eventually, I mean, very soon, my mother went and bought the record for me. I mean, she came home with it tucked under her arm. She had gone to Camelot Records and Tapes, and she came with the album. And my two sisters and I, you know, we just like, whoa, you know, we opened it up and took the plastic off. It was like, you know.
That must have been a huge moment.
It was. It was like, wow, we have it finally. Well, there's Michael Jackson, you know, reclining in this gorgeous white suit that seems to glow, you know. And
yeah, he's kind of backlit as well.
Right.
So his hair is kind of shining.
Absolutely. Yeah, his hair is glistening, you know, nice Jerry Curl going on. And it was, he seemed otherworldly. You know, Michael Jackson at that point, you know, every time he was on TV or anybody mentioned his name, it was, you know, instant screams and, you know, your eyes widened because he was just this, he wasn't even human, okay? He was this otherworldly being.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Rashad, but I seem to remember that on that album cover, he was also actually petting a baby tiger. Am I imagining
right,
that?
Right, that was the, absolutely, that was the gatefold picture. When you open up the album on the inside, there he is reclining, and the it was a tiger cub that was on his knee, and he's petting it. And it's like, what? And, you know, and he, all the backlighting, it just added to the mystique of this incredible pop star. And then I remember we took the album out, and we were in my room, and I remember I had this record player that stood almost as high as I did. It was like a mock jukebox. It was rectangular shaped red and had lights in the center of it that would, you know, move to the beat of the music,
wow,
synchronize the music. And the top had this clear plastic globe on it. So you lift it and you put the record on. And this was in the evening. So once I dropped the needle and it slid into the grooves of I Want to Be Starting Something, the first cut on that on side one, we turned the lights off and let the lights, you know, kind of bounce off the walls from the record player.
And, you know, instant, it was disco.
Instant disco. And it was instant fun. I mean, my sisters and I danced that album all night long.
So you wanna be starting something, you got to be starting something. I said you wanna be starting something, you got to be starting something.
And that whole break, I'm gonna say I'm beside my cousin, you know, that whole thing. And you know, it was like, whoa. You know, it, although we had heard that song in the neighborhood, and even some radio stations were playing, you know, album cuts at that point, it was still like, wow, you know, we turned it all the way up the record player. Of course, Mama came in and was like, y'all need to turn that down. If y'all gonna play it, y'all need to turn it down just a little bit. But
she was already regretting her decision of getting the record player.
Probably so. But, you know, we were, I mean, it was like, you know, we screamed like, that's the jam, turn it up. And I think we may have listened to it that night. We listened to the record twice before, you know, Mama told us to turn it off and go to bed.
So why do you think your mom surprised you with this record? I mean, it sounds like it wasn't something you were expecting.
No, I wasn't expecting it. I mean, Mama worked all the time. And so when she came home, I remember it was a Friday and she had stopped after work and got the album. You know, I think that, you know, she knew very early on how much music meant to me. And I don't know if she knew how to help me, you know, with the sadness I was feeling. But I guess, you know, being a mother, she was intuitive. I guess she knew that music would help. I mean, she knew that, you know, if I was pretty withdrawn at that time and, you know, spent a lot of time in my room listening to records. And so she surprised me with this album.
Rashad was in second grade, and at the time he was bused out to a suburban school. He was the only black kid in his class. It was lonely. He mostly sat in the back of the classroom and didn't talk, hoping not to be noticed. But when Rashad got his Thriller record, he did what any respectable elementary school kid would have thought to do. He brought his new album into school for show and tell.
I had the album with me at the bus stop. And at the bus stop, I mean, you know, these were like very bratty kids. I mean, I think these kids were worse than, you know, South Park kids. You know, they were just foul. And so, I mean, usually, you know, as I said, I was the quiet kid who just kind of stood back and, you know, no one said anything to me, really. And so I remember that morning when I had the album with my books, you know, kids stopped like, wait, look, he got Thriller, you know, and on the bus, folks wanted to see the album and, you know, wanted to, you know, they passed it around and wanted to look at it. And you know, when I got to school, show and tell, I was one of the first people to get up and, you know, I showed off the album and was telling my classmates, oh, this is my favorite record. I said it was the best record ever made, you know? And I was like, the best record ever made is my favorite album. I showed off the gatefold picture and, you know, the oohs and the ahs rippled through the classroom. And Miss Mathis, my teacher, put the album on and, you know, it got out of control instantly.
Oh, my
like,
God.
It was a grade school disco up in there. Everyone gets up at the desk and start dancing, you know, just out of control, you know, because that's what the music did. There was no way you're going to sit in your chair and not, you know, and listen to the song. You were going to get up. Once it got well into the song, you know, and we were all on the floor dancing around and dancing at our desk, you know, Miss Mathis turned it off and was like, okay, everybody settle down, please, get in your seats, you know. We were loud.
Rashad was the most popular kid in school that day. And although his classroom popularity didn't last, his love of pop music has never left him. These days, Rashad works as a music critic for the Baltimore Sun. In a moment, we'll hear Rashad's professional take on that Michael Jackson album that meant so much to him as a kid. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. From American Public Media, this is The Story.
This is Vincent Price. Michael Jackson is the Thriller. Can you dig it?
I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Story. That's, of course, the voice of Vincent Price that embroidered an album that would become an icon. It hit the scene 25 years ago, and today, Thriller stands as one of the top-selling and most influential records of all time. There's a new anniversary release out this year. It includes commentary from the album's producer, Quincy Jones.
When a record goes to number one, everything then from, as I said, starts with songs. We got killer songs that went everywhere. And I don't think it's an accident that it hit everybody from 8 to 70, man, everywhere in the world. That's never happened before. I mean, you know, a young black kid to be the idol of so many millions of kids all over the world, it never happened really before. Not on that level, you know.
This year's Thriller 25 reissue also includes never-before-heard tracks, like this Michael Jackson rehearsal session of Billie Jean.
More kicking stuff in the phones, I need it. More bottom and kick in the phones.
Now that song alone has influenced a raft of imitators. Just this week, one of the American Idol finalists, David Cook, sang his own version.
She was more like a beauty queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I'm the one who will dance on the floor in the round. She said, I am the one who danced on the floor in the round. She told me her name was Billie Jean as she caused a scene. Then every head I turned with eyes it dreamed of being the one who danced on the floor in the round. People always told me, be careful what you do. Don't go around breaking your girl.
Now, Michael Jackson's Thriller didn't just influence music. If you were a kid 25 years ago, it influenced everything about what you thought was cool. And for better or worse, the kids of my generation were turned into moonwalking, one-glove-wearing fanatics in parachute pants. Rashad Allison remembers it too. He was in elementary school back in the early 80s.
I wanted the jacket, and Mama was like, no.
You know what? I'll make a confession. I wanted that too. I totally
wanted
it. Yeah,
I wanted the jacket, and, you know, I wore, you know, little church boy haircut, you know, it was shaved with a part on the side, and I wanted to grow my hair out so I can have a Jerry curl like Michael Jackson. Mama was like, absolutely not. But so I didn't get the jacket, but I remember that the image was just as powerful as the music. I mean, people went around, even just on regular days, dressed like Michael Jackson. I remember guys in
right.
projects where I lived, the older cats and the teenagers had the glitter socks on.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, where did you find the glitter socks? But I do remember people just every day, you know, Michael Jackson trying to incorporate a little of his style into their own.
Now, a few minutes ago, we heard Rashad tell about the day he brought his Thriller album into school for show and tell. It temporarily turned his classroom into a second-grade dance party and made him the most popular kid in school. For a day. But Rashad had always been a loner, and after his brief moment in the spotlight, he went back to being that quiet kid that no one really paid attention to.
Kids are very fickle. So, yeah. You know, when I guess if I wanted friends every day, I needed to bring the Thriller album every day. But, I mean, there was one little boy who sat next to me, Jacob, who you know, he talked to me when I had the Thriller album. And, you know, we became little friends at school. You know, we played at recess. We sat together at lunch. And so it kind of opened up, you know, well, it opened up that little friendship I had that year.
Now, how about the way things were at home? Did the album's magic change life for you at home at all?
It did. You know, well, it helped. I mean, it instantly, it took me out of, you know, the bit of the depression I was feeling because my parents were divorced. So I still miss that, you know, my parents weren't together, but Thriller just brought this kind of joy and happiness, you know, that was, you know, that I didn't have because he was gone. You know, it was just sort of, you know, oh, I have this Thriller album I can concentrate on right now. You know, it just felt good.
Now, when you were at home during that time and you'd listen to the album, was there any particular cut off the album that particularly cheered you up?
When we started something, I loved, of course, Billie Jean. You know, the big singles off of it. But there was some great album cuts. I remember, you know, being that young and loving the last cut on the album, Lady in My Life. I mean, because it was just lovely slow jam.
There'll be no darkness tonight. Lady, your love will shine,
lighting the light.
Just put your trust in my heart and meet me in paradise.
Now is the time.
Girl, you're every wonder in this world to me.
I know a lot of black stations at that time played that cut during their Quiet Storm hour. But, you know, he sang that song so sweetly. And, you know, I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't, you know, think, oh, romantic romance. You know, I just thought this is a very beautiful melodic song. You know, lyrically, the album didn't speak to the situation I was going through. But it did offer, you know, this nice window of escape. You know, just this, you know, nice area where the music was fun and harmless, and it just made you feel good. You know, it was nice therapy.
Yeah, it almost sounds, from what you're saying, like this album was sort of a constant companion and confidant that you could kind of count on during that time.
It really was, because I played it all the time, and it was just, it just, I guess it was like almost a security blanket at one point. And I believe that was the first album my mother had bought me, because my father bought all the music before. So, you know, it had that sentimental value too.
Nowadays, 25 years after his childhood fascination with Thriller, Rashad Olison is a music critic for the Baltimore Sun. With the release this year of the Thriller anniversary album, Rashad has had a chance to revisit the music and reflect on what's behind its magic.
Before Thriller, you know, music was just this nice place, this world to be in. But, you know, I was interested with Thriller how music is this very personal thing for people. You know, I'm really interested in just the human connection people have with pop music. Even the most disposable stuff, there's still a need for music, you know, in people's lives. Mm-hmm. And I mean, with Thriller, it helped me realize just how important that is for us, you know, to have music to make us feel better, you know, just for that sense, or just for company, you know. Thriller, Michael Jackson's Thriller, it was the perfect pop album, you know. And you know, pop music, at least the way I've thought of it, has always been this world where, you know, fantasies are indulged and, you know, fantasies come to life, you know, and you can leave wherever you are and go here, and this is a nice place. And that pretty much influenced me to, you know, write about music in that sense, you know, what it means beyond just, oh, this is this chord change, you know, just pretty much writing about the human element of music.
So, do you still throw on the Thriller album once in a while? When's the last time you've given it a listen?
Well, the last time I gave it a listen, of course, when I wrote about the reissue, you know, I can't help but smile and listen to it. I mean, whenever I felt a little depressed, a little low, you know, that's one of the records I can put on. And just when I just need to get out of that funk for a minute and just feel good and not, you know, have music to speak to what I'm going through right now, just to say, oh, forget it, I just want to, you know, leave this space for a minute. That's one of the albums.
Now, this may be a tough question to answer, but if you had to choose, do you have a favorite song on the Thriller album?
You know, now I appreciate Human Nature. Early on, that would be one of the songs it would play, but I would either not pay attention to it or I would sometimes skip it. But that song now I can appreciate.
Out across the night, the city winks as sleep as I hear her voice shake my window, sweet seducing sighs.
And I appreciate now for sort of the jazzy inflections and the synthesized arrangement. Michael's vocals are very relaxed and behind the beat a little bit. And, you know, now, as a grown man and as a music critic, I appreciate that cut probably the most off of that album.
Then let me take a bite. If they say why, tell them that it's human nature. Why, does he do it that way? If they say why, tell them that it's human nature.
You can find links to Rashad Olison's articles and more info about the 25th anniversary of Thriller on our website, thestory.org.
That girl, she knows I'm watching. She likes the way I stare. If they say why,
I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. We're going to turn now to a conversation between Dick and a man named Frank Brown. Frank had planned to be a minister, but in his early 20s, he dropped out of divinity school, and he started hopping around from job to job. Then he decided to pursue his real dream, to be in a band.
I wanted a Gibson Thunderbird bass. That was what I wanted.
How much would that have cost back then,
Frank? I think I paid $270 for it.
That's a lot of money in the early 60s.
I mean, this is 64. It took me, by that time, I had to work in a drugstore. Mm. And I would work the weekends. I mean, that was where I was most every free moment on the weekends, double shifts if I could get it, for a dollar an hour. Boy, I was really making a killing. Dollar an hour.
Socking it all away for that Gibson.
And I get it home, and I'm going, oh, this thing's beautiful. It's just one big piece of mahogany, real.
And it's shiny.
Oh, yeah. It's shiny and new, you know. It's still just kind of, you start to play it and realize you have no clue what you're doing. Oh, and I can remember the first day I was so frustrated, I just cried. I was so angry. I could hear what was in the record. I could hear the bass player. I couldn't emulate it in any way
How
possible.
How old were you at the time?
Around 16.
Was there a musician at the time or a band that at the time that you thought, yeah, that could be me? Or
one of my favorite bands was Frank Zappa. Now, you talk about trying to copy somebody. Hey,
you picked someone difficult.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is like the Mozart of our time. This guy is a genius, and his bass players only last a year. All of his musicians last a year. He burned them out.
Yeah.
He was so far ahead on everything. And so I would try to play along with the records. Well, you can get one or two notes out of a whole record, maybe, if you're lucky. And that was me.
So were you permanently, were you in a state of permanent discouragement as a result or what?
It took 4 or 5 months of driving my parents crazy playing all the time until I finally started getting into understanding the notes and where things went in music and the patterns. And then after that, it was just learning all the music.
Did it get your place in the high school band?
Oh, no.
No high school band, no other group of musicians?
I'm working on the weekends. There's really not a lot of time to do anything other than the only time that I could say I stood on stage with a band was at the high school. You know, they have talent nights. Mm-hmm. And so we sat down and did a couple of Beatle numbers.
Do you remember which ones?
Nowhere Man and You're Gonna Lose That Girl.
You're gonna lose that girl. Yes, you're gonna lose that girl.
How was it?
It was tough, really tough competition. We had another group that was doing Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, and they were really good.
Yeah, the trumpet player knew what he was doing.
They had a whole brass section from the band, and they were pretty good.
That's
and we're
not
going,
fair.
Oh man, this is. But we took first place. So
congratulations.
We're more than happy. Well, thank you. Long time ago.
Fair enough. But was there a time though, Frank, when you felt like you had to let go of this dream of one day joining Frank Zappa on stage? I mean, we all have those kinds of dreams as kids.
When I was going through high school, I had every intention of being a pastor in a Lutheran church.
With an electric bass slung over one shoulder?
Well, see, that was just an amusement, you might say.
Okay.
The bass was not, it was a part of my life, but it wasn't the primary part of my life. And I went to VCU, and my senior year decided that because of the number of thoughts going through my head that were carnal in knowledge, I wasn't ready for the ministry. This is probably something I shouldn't do. So I just decided one day I wasn't going to go. I quit school, went in, became a mechanic, and started playing little weekend bands like in Holiday Inns and so forth. And just did the ordinary thing, you know, was married, had a child. And then one day, this music store that I took my first guitar lessons from, and they get a call that this group is coming into town and needs a bass player for a show at the mosque. And the mosque is a beautiful theater. It has the big tiers, the gold, you know, the candelabras and chandeliers from the ceilings and all the alcoves in the sides. Yeah. And it's gorgeous. A great place to perform because the acoustics are so good.
And everybody's close to you.
Yeah, yes. It's kind of those old-timey places where you look at and just think, wow, must have been amazing to play there. So this group came to town, and I ended up getting the call. They gave them my number, and they called me and said, would you come in, and we need you for a show tomorrow. And I said, sure.
Well, tell me about your moment on stage in front of a full house.
We got through one number, then through two, then three, and then you get into a little bit of comfort zone. It was just enjoyment of playing music. It put me in a different place, and I liked being there. It was a great feeling. nothing like entertaining people, and then when you've done a really good job, walking away and go, that was kind of nice.
Frank Brown didn't stay in the music industry. He became a contractor. But he did have another moment of musical fame, playing at his high school reunion. Coming up, a revelatory cross-country road trip with some unusual company riding shotgun, Marshmallow Peeps on the Open Road. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. From American Public Media, this is The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Well, it's the week after Easter, a time when we find ourselves waiting in line at the grocery store and perhaps staring with numb fascination at all those unbought marshmallow peeps left over in the 75% off bin. Where will they all go? Well, as you're about to hear, some peeps are luckier than others. Meet Libby Stellis. She's a Seattle woman who just had a momentous birthday, and she was reassessing her goals and priorities.
Well, you know, after I turned 50, which happens to a lot of us, I began to kind of look around at my life. I was single, a single mother. But it wasn't until I was taking my daughter around to colleges that I began to have this sense of, could I have a do-over? I'd like to go to college again or do something different, perhaps. But I began to really realize that I just had this desire to get in my car and leave and go and travel. The other thing that was happening at the time is I was doing some work with seniors, home care, and on the side. And I saw lots of different people in their 80s living a variety of different kinds of life. And I had this urge to go on an adventure because I just wanted to make sure that when I was in my 80s that I had done something like that. And I didn't do it in my 20s, so it was sort of time to do my adventure.
Libby decided that adventure would take the form of an extended cross-country road trip. Before she took off, she got together with some girlfriends for a farewell party. They each gave Libby a little memento to take with her on her adventure.
And one of the women, Pat, gave me a package of yellow bunny peeps. I looked at her and I said, Pat? And she said, oh, I thought you loved peeps. I thought you could use them as a snack in the car. And then I had to admit that actually I'd outgrown my enjoyment of peeps, but that I would take the peeps with me. So as a group, we got talking about it, and I said, you know what? I'll call it the Peeps Pilgrimage because it was a trip where I was wanting to discover myself and discover whether there was a new place I wanted to live. And so it was that sort of kind of journey. And we got laughing about it, and I said, I will take pictures with the peeps, and I will send them back to you.
So the peeps began as they started as a snack, but then soon got elevated to a much higher purpose.
Yes, much higher purpose. Friends to have within the car. Yeah. I started, you know, there was Polly and Penny and Pat. Of course, one of them had to be called Pat. And I think Pam was the other one. And so, you know, I drove 18,000 miles and most of that was all by myself. So I had these little buddies with me and occasionally I would have conversations with them. But then they also became a way to sort of look for opportunities to take pictures that would be fun. And then quickly it became a way to meet people.
Now, tell me about some of the highlights, some of the adventures that you had along the way on this trip. I mean, what's the first big adventure that you remember about this?
Well, the first one that I remember is in Northern California on Interstate 5. Oh, it's exit 700 and something. There is an exit, and the name of the exit, believe it or not, is Easy Street and Shamrock Road. And I had to get off because I wanted to be able to go on Easy Street. I wanted a picture of the peeps on the strip at night, and I wanted to have them take a picture in front of one of the casinos and that they would play the slots. And so the things that you would do at various stops, I made sure that the Peeps got incorporated in. After Las Vegas, I went down across Hoover Dam and along Route 66 and to the Grand Canyon and then down into Sedona. And by the time I got to Sedona, it was still before Easter, but my original Peeps were looking a little weary. They'd started to lose their yellow coloring, and one of them had a little broken ear. And so I realized that in a whole year of travel, this original Peeps might not make it. So I went into a store, since it was still before Easter, and bought, I think, 10 packages of Bunny Peeps so that I would not be without them in case anything happened to one of them along the way.
So you just wanted to have some Peeps with you. It wasn't so much the original Peeps that were so important.
No, but I do have the original Peeps. I kept them, but for picture purposes. And that was a wonderful occasion of meeting and getting to know people, because as I had these 10 packages of Peeps, as I went up to the checkout stand, I shared with the cashier and then some other people who were in line what I was doing. And I wanted to know if anybody had a good idea of how I could preserve the Peeps better. And so there was a big discussion about, oh, you should get some hairspray and spray them with hairspray or shellac. So at one point, I think there were three or four of us discussing how I could preserve the Peeps the best way.
There was an original point to this journey, to sort of find something new out there, rediscover yourself in a way. And I wonder if at this point, there in Arizona, if you were anywhere closer to finding what you were looking for.
What I discovered was that there was a pattern in my life, which is experiences that happened to me positively or negatively, but I'm a person who always looks for the meaning in things, that there is a meaning and a purpose in everything that happens to us. My sister says that I look for the deeper meaning of a sneeze, which is probably true. And it's kind of a joke in my family. Oh, there's Libby looking for the, you know, deeper meaning of a potato or something. I realized that that is true about me and that I like that. And more importantly, I like to help people who are in a search for deeper meaning. And that when I looked at the work that I had most enjoyed over the years, teaching in a high school, working with victims of abuse and domestic violence, that what I really felt a lot of satisfaction about was a point at which someone could put something together and make meaning with what had happened to them, and then have hope that their life could be better, different, changed as a result of holding on to that meaning.
Now, odd as it seems, Libby's own search for meaning was really enhanced by the absurd premise of these little sugar-coated marshmallow bunnies. They gave her an excuse to break the ice, strike up conversations with strangers that she otherwise never would have met. Libby has photos of her Peeps with an Elvis impersonator, a drag queen, a security guard. And the Peeps also got to meet some of Libby's old friends along the way.
The first old friend that I got to see was my childhood friend Marie, who lived north of New Orleans. I was seeing her for the first time in 29 years.
I always find whenever I see old friends that it really gives you an opportunity to kind of reassess yourself from kind of, because it reminds you in a way sort of the way you were then and where you've come as a person since.
Yeah, really does. And Marie was able to say things to me about, well, you know, you were always good at listening. You were always good at helping people. And I'd look at her and I'd kind of go, well, gee, I mean, she's known me. We met when I was 7, 8. So it validated some things for me. And then we could also kid each other about habits we still have. Right. Or she would say something or I would say something and we go, you know, you used to do that when you were 10.
So you changed in some ways and remained the same in others.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a very kind of home feeling, and yet we'd lived very different lives. We're kind of representative of baby boomers in two different ways, because Marie got married just out of high school. She married a man who was in the Navy, who didn't go to Vietnam but could have. And her children were born, I think, all before she was 22 or 23. I, on the other hand, went to college, went to graduate school, taught school, didn't get married until I was 27, didn't have my child until I was 33. So we actually, in life experiences, are kind of both ends of the spectrum of baby boomers in the way our generation kind of went in two different directions. So we lived very different lives, but we still have a lot of common ground.
Right. Nonetheless, it was easy to reminisce together, I imagine, like as if not that much time had passed at all.
Oh, absolutely. And to talk about the present, you know, to talk about what's important now and the joys and sorrows of going through menopause. And, you know, so we still could connect. Then I went on to New Jersey in time for my 35th high school reunion, which was not a large, I went to a small school. It wasn't a large group, but it was a chance to connect with all of those women.
Now, what did your old classmates think? Did you pull the peeps out there? What did they think?
Oh,
when
yeah,
they thought,
oh, their picture here, of the, yeah.
There's Libby, sure, and she's got some marshmallow peeps with her. What in the world is going
yeah.
on?
Yeah, well, they were like, what? Well, again, it kind of validated a certain spunkiness that I had forgotten I'd had in me, and they all seemed to think it was something that they would expect me to do. Huh. And I was like, really? And as I talked about it, I was aware that maybe I was reawakening a part of me that was there when I was younger that was willing to take risks or try something different or do something goofy. And so they were thrilled. And one of the women that I went to high school with is in the administration of Lehigh University, which is in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where the Just Born candy company that makes Peeps is. And so she was able to help me find my way to the Peeps factory. So I got to go actually to the homeland of the Peeps.
As you might suspect, Libby got a very warm reception at the Peeps factory in Pennsylvania. The folks there made sure that she was well stocked with complimentary candies before she set off on the next leg of her adventure. Libby caught up with her daughter. And from New Jersey, the two of them spent some quality time traveling together out west, with the Peeps, of course.
I think she was proud of her mother and kind of enjoyed that her mother was doing kind of a crazy thing. I don't recall her ever asking me, what's the point? She really enjoyed, I wrote on a blog, so I wrote my reflections a couple of times a week, and she really enjoyed reading them. And we talked about what it meant to trust to take an adventure, that at the end of it, you would know something that would be helpful or meaningful in your life to move on. And then she did actually get to be with me for two parts of the adventure. What we did was we drove from New Jersey to Chicago to have that trip because she's a history of art major and she wanted to go to the Chicago Institute of Art, and I'd never been to it, so I said, well, let's go. I have the car. We'll go. And then she flew on from there. And then at the end of August, by that point, I had received two invitations to spend time in Hawaii for the end of my part of my trip. And I needed to get my car back to Seattle in order to go to Hawaii. So she flew out, and we spent 10 days driving across the country. And that's probably one of the most precious parts of the trip because she likes to be with her mother. She's 20 years old, which is unique in and of itself. And I knew that because her life was going to grow and change and get busier with all the new things she'd be learning and exploring, especially when she got out of college, that I might not get 10 days alone with my daughter in quite some time. It could be years from now before we'd have another occasion to do that. So we just had a great time going to cheese factories in Wisconsin and Mount Rushmore and thinking of crazy places to take the Peeps, including the Corn Palace in South Dakota and all these hysterical pictures. We found a buffalo that was in a corral, and we figured out how I could get close enough to the buffalo to get the Peeps with the buffalo, and it was great fun.
Do you think those 10 days that you got to spend with your daughter helped you along your way as far as what you were trying to get out of this whole adventure?
I think so, because, you know, what I discovered when a child leaves home, at least for me, is that I think often we think that we are their anchor, that they're the kite that flies and we're kind of holding on to them, helping them fly. But I think in some ways, especially having an only child, perhaps, and an only daughter, that she was an anchor for me during her growing up because it organized my life. And in the time we got to spend together, we sort of reconnected and recreated our relationship as more of more adult to adult. I'm still her mom, and there's still lots of things to help her with, but she's a young lady now. She's a young woman. So we could have conversations about what would be important in a relationship and what kind of work would be meaningful and all kinds of things that I think helped us shift our relationship to a slightly more peer relationship than it had been before she started college.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. Libby spent almost a year on the road. She'd seen the country, met new people, caught up with old friends, and reconnected with her daughter. And then, just as spontaneously as she'd decided to take this trip, Libby decided it was time to end it. The realization came to her one night while she was watching The Wizard of Oz.
I caught it on, I don't know, Turner Classic Movies or something like that, and it was the end of the movie, the scene where the wizard has just taken off in the balloon without her, and she's in a panic. And she says, well, how will I get home? And Glenda says to her, well, you've always been able to get home.
Oh, will you help me? Can you help me? You don't need to be helped any longer. You've always had the power to go back to Kansas.
I have.
Then why didn't you tell her before?
Because she wouldn't have believed me. She had to learn it for herself.
What have you learned, Dorothy?
And in the end, that's what I discovered, is that my heart's desire was with me. In my own backyard, physically with Seattle, but also within myself. While the adventure was a great adventure and the peeps were so much fun to be with, I could have discovered that perhaps in many other ways, and that the people in my life helped remind me, just like in The Wizard of Oz, when she then wakes up back in her home and she's so excited to see her Aunt Em and all the people, and she can say there's no place like home. You know, if I can leave a word to anyone else who's thinking of taking an adventure, I would say be cautiously stupid about it, which means there's things to remember and to be cautious about, but there's a certain stupidity that gets us to just do it. And it's courageous and it's fun, and I guarantee that you will find something you didn't know, and you'll find something you do know about yourself, and your life will be much richer for it.
Libby Stellis joined me from Seattle, where she's been living for the past year. That's where her road trip began and where it ended. If you'd like to see photos from Libby's adventure or read the online journal that she kept during the trip, you can find links at our website, thestory.org. Now, if you've got an interesting story of your own about travel and self-discovery, maybe a spontaneous decision that gave you a new outlook on life, be in touch. Here's the website again, thestory.org. The Story is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley. Rachel McCarthy is sitting in this week also. Our researcher is Jeanette Arrowood. Jen Nathan is our audio editor. And Al Wodarski and Peter Bombar are our engineers. The Story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer of The Story is Greg Kelly. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. It's been great spending the week with you. Dick returns to the air on Monday. From American Public Media, this is The Story. Thank you.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.